Welcome to the History Sybil, and today I'm going to be sharing with you excerpts from a chapter on my book, The Sorcery Charge, unpublished book, from the series Secret History of the Witches. It's volume 12, I think. I lost count. But I'm going to be talking about a chapter on Inquisitorial Crusades, and this has to do with repression of heterodox Christians, as they would say in academia, Christians who did not follow the dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. And I want to start with a quote here, which applies to these believers that were diverging from doctrine, from the hierarchy's interpretation. And here it is. "But we desire to hear from you what your views are, for with regard to this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against." So this is not from France in the 1300s. This is Acts 28:22 in the Christian Bible. And they're talking about the early Christian movement in the early days, and maybe what we can't even really call it Christianity at this phase. It's a Jewish movement, which later gets deflected by Paul of Tarsus off into something else, that a Romanized version, a Hellenized version, that we know as Christianity, or maybe we should be better calling it Paulianity. But in the 14th century, in Western Europe, Christians were still scurrying for cover from enemies in high places. But this time their persecutors claimed to be the only true Christians. And so Cathars drew fire from the Inquisition in its early years. That was really the reason for starting the Inquisition, was to stamp out this heretical movement. Heresy meaning choice in Greek. This term goes back a long ways. And they succeeded in stamping out the Cathars by the end of the 1200s, just maybe a few shreds left here and there. And then it was the turn of the Valdenses, as we know them in English. Vaudois is the term in French, the followers of Peter Valdo. And they too were persecuted because they repudiated canon law that was made by the bishops. And they gave up on all church customs that weren't found in the Bible, and that included the feasts of saints, Easter, candlelighting, pilgrimage sites, which were really pagan in origin in many cases. And they hewed to the Bible, which they translated into the vernacular languages, into French and the other languages of the movement. And so the church hierarchy was threatened by these alternative interpretations of the Christian scriptures, and they responded by outlawing their own Bible. You know, the Bible had to be in Latin, could not be translated, and it could not be held, could not be possessed by lay people. It had to be under the control of the church. The exception maybe being the books of hours that the aristocrats were allowed to have. But that was their own liturgy. It wasn't really the biblical text itself. And of all the heretics that the church hunted, the Waldenses were the most successful survivors. And they succeeded in creating an international underground movement. They used passwords sometimes to be able to identify themselves to each other. And these were primarily commoners. Some of them had a reputation as being skillful healers. And so they fled the Inquisition out of southern France for the protection of the Western Alps. They headed for the hills. And so they went to Dauphiné, Piemonte, Savoy, and parts of Switzerland. And others ran to secret communities in northern Italy, Germany, and Bohemia, which is now the Czech Republic. And so their religious teachers often earned their living as traveling tradespeople, peddlers, tinkers, bootmakers, commoner professions, humble people. And these occupations provided a cover that warded off suspicion from the clergy, because people like that, tinkers, traveled around. And so this didn't really attract notice. And they passed as Catholics, and they blended easily among the common people and tried as much as possible to avoid priests and church and communion and confession and all the other enforcements of the authority of the hierarchy. And so at first for them, the local bishops caused more problems than the Inquisition. But that changed over time. I'll make a mention here about had a fairly strong position as Christian women go, reminiscent of some of the early Christian deaconesses. They participated in all of the religious activities, and we see priests complaining that women often led prayers and preached and taught, and that was considered by them highly inappropriate. This was to be a completely all-male preserve. But their standing, women's standing, weakened first in the areas where the persecutions were the most severe. And so during the first ravages of the Inquisition during the late 1200s on this community, men began excluding women from chapter membership in southern France. And when you go up into the hills, it seems to have taken a century longer for this women's subordination to extend into the hill country. But by the 1400s, they too had been pushed out of public leadership. So this is another example about how repression can lead to increased repression within communities. And so one of the names for the traveling teachers and elders, marking them as male, they had come to be known as barbe, the beards, bearded ones. But they migrate to the Alpine valleys and settle among the mountain people who are barely touched in this period in the 1200s by canon lawyers and theologians. They were remote communities out there in the mountains, and they preserved many pagan customs and ethnic culture of pre-Germanic and even pre-Celtic peoples. And they were fiercely independent, and they resisted outside control. One source calls them barely Christianized, for the most part independent of seigneurial power, the lords, right? And organized in their archaic form of primitive collectivism. I think that might be Henry Charles Lee. And so these Vaudois refugees settled peacefully among the mountain people until inquisitors came looking for them, looking for heretics, and found them sheltered there in these mountain communities that were steeped in animist traditions. So Lee gives us several late medieval examples of nature worship that friars preaching in the Western Alps came across. In 1387, Fra Antonio Secco wrote that a peasant confessed to adoring the sun and moon. And Vicente Ferrer saw peasants in Lausanne, this would be Switzerland, making reverence to the rising sun in 1403. And there was a fairy faith also in these regions, as we find all over Western Europe. One area where the Vaudois settled was the Luberon region of Provence. And one source that's called The Time of the Vaudois, this is a French book, calls it Luberon of Lost Enchantments, where people still believe in the virtue of plants and in magical signs engraved on rocks. So this is very, very old tradition that's surviving. These are like reservoirs, these mountain communities, reservoir pockets of much older cultural heritages, not yet reached by feudalism and Romans or the church. And so this district, Luberon, used to be called Val Masque, the Valley of the Witches. Masca or masque is a term that we see both in France and Italy in like the 800s, 700s as a name for witches. So the Inquisition comes up to the Western Alps in 1288 at Embrun, 1290 in Briançon, 1292 in the Italian foothills of the Alps at Piemonte. And we don't have a real clear record of the prosecutions, but we see that the Inquisition was moving to execute Vaudois people, put them to the stake as the 1300s open. Already we find in 1312 a woman being burned for Valdésie, for being a Valdense at Pignerol. And by 1315, the Hounds of the Lord as they called themselves, were scouring the high valleys of Dauphiné. This is all in southeastern France. The mountain dwellers, whether they were belonged to the Waldenses believers or not, they fought back, especially when the persecutions reached the Italian side of the Alps. And so in 1322, right after an inquisitor had begun operating in the valley of Angrogne, a priest suspected of denouncing heretics to the Inquisition was killed in Piemonte. And more inquisitors were sent into Val Lucerne in 1332. And we still see Vaudois Christians operating in the open in this period in the villages around Turin. But when the Inquisition stepped up its attacks on the Vaudois, the people rose up and they besieged the Inquisitor of Turin in his castle. This is from Lee's A History of the Inquisition. Lots of interesting stories in there. So the inquisitors began soon to exploit the sorcery charged in its war on the Waldenses. And they fell back on the old pattern of calumniating heretics as magical evildoers. And this is something that was already going on in the 1200s. Earlier, in fact, if we look at the late Roman history. But in 1250, for example, we see Spanish Waldenses being called los incabats or insabati. And so there's this idea of, it's really an anti-Semitic term, this sabbat terminology that's used against witches and heretics in this period. The word synagoga is also applied to both groups for their gatherings. And so we're seeing here the germ of the diabolist term of devilish sabbats already at this very early date. But this name Vaudois began to take on the new meaning of sorcerer. And so this was happening all the way up north in the Low Countries, in Flanders, where rulers and prelates both felt threatened by heretical weavers who were organizing the cloth workers. And some of them were using biblical interpretations to support their movement. And so in the early 1300s, this imputation of sorcery spread to French trials of the Vaudois Christians. And so we have Inquisitor of Toulouse, Bernard Guy, repeating accusations that the Vaudois practice sexual abominations in nocturnal assemblies when a demonic dog spindles the sectaries with his tail. So we've got a little image of sexual penetration being projected there. And it's really hard by the end of the 1300s to tell from these very sketchy and often unreliable records whether the Vaudois being attacked were biblical Christians or their largely pagan mountain neighbors who are making excellent targets for sorcery accusations. And so the church begins to pressure the lords in these highlands, the aristocrats, to take action against the heretics that are settled in their domains. And the lords, the knights, responded with great eagerness because they knew they were going to get to pocket a share of the confiscation, the confiscated property. This is part of the inquisitorial method, is they would take everything, including land, that a person who was accused owned, and it would be taken by the church. And so these knights mounted their first military expedition against the mountain people in 1336. And then we have the Inquisitor of Embrun setting up operations in Valpute, which became very quickly famous for its witch trials. So that transformation, the shift from heretics to witches under the Inquisition, is very clear here. And we're told that the year 1338, that's just very soon after the arrival of the Inquisition in the High Valleys, 1338 was a year of terror, torture trials, executions, burning at the stake. And we see feudal lords invading villages with the blessing of the church in 1344 and again 5 years later. And so the executions ordered by the Holy Office, the Holy Office of the Inquisition, that's the full title, as the church called themselves, were not done by the church. They had a fiction, Ecclesia abhorret sanguine, the church abhors the shedding of blood. And so this had to be carried out by knights and soldiers. They had to have the backup of the ruling class to do these persecutions. But the mountain people, although they were really hard pressed, were undaunted, and they assassinated another inquisitor of Angronia in 1351. And the lords of Lucerne denounced more people as heretics to the next inquisitor in 1354. And this brought more blood and fire to rural hamlets for three terrible years. In 1363, Pope Urban V commanded the governor of Dauphiné to stamp out the Vaudois. And so for 2 years, armies are marching up to remote villages, firing, raping, and looting, and dragging their captives back to Embrun, where the inquisitors were installed, and to Grenoble and to Briançon to be tortured and burned. And so these people saw their homesteads destroyed. The survivors' shattered families withstood terrible hardship while living under the baleful eye of the inquisitors. And you see waves of refugees escaping to safer valleys and being given shelter there. This is really, the compassion that was given by these communities, which put them their own selves in danger to give refuge. And generations later, these same communities, in their turn, gave refuge to new victims of the church militant. And so in the northwestern Alps, the people reached their breaking point in 1365. And they rose up en masse in the Jacquerie of Savoie. This is one of the great peasant revolts of the 1300s. And the Vaudois participated in this uprising along with Catholics and not quite Catholics, the whole spectrum of the common people. This is part of a wave of peasant revolts that happened in the 1300s in the wake of the Great Plague. And there's a lot more complicated social causes going on there. But one of the things that happened is it broke temporarily the power of the ruling class because the mortality was so great and the whole economy was in shambles. And so you see a lot of worker uprisings in the second half of the 1300s, the weavers in Belgium, and many, many examples in England as well, the peasantry. So this rebellion and all the others were suppressed by the aristocracy and with waves of more brutal reprisals. And so there's Savoie smoldering in helpless rage in the wake of these heeled boots on the populace. And that rage quickly found outlets in pogroms and witch hunts. And this was a response that was happening also around the plague as well as around the peasant revolts. So in the 1370s, we still see the church hounding the Alpine people with more arrests, confiscations, imprisonments, torture trials, and burnings. And even though they did burn many, the bishops were hard put to imprison everyone. They couldn't feed all the captives that were taken. And the situation was so bad that in 1376, Gregory the 11th, this is a pope, appealed to Christians for money to expand the overcrowded dungeons that they were holding all these prisoners and to keep them from starving to death before they could be executed. There's the milk of human kindness for you. Charity demanded it. More money to the church. So the outrage at the cruelties of the Holy Office provoked the killing of the inquisitor at Briqueras in 1374. And an inquisitor named Borelli of Gap led a party of knights in slaughtering villagers, including children, at the high mountain village of Pragelato in 1375. The few survivors, their village burnt to the ground, managed to escape into the wilderness only with the clothes on their backs, leaving their murdered relatives and neighbors unburied. But Borelli, who was the Franciscan inquisitor of Provence and Dauphiné, was not satisfied to collect denunciations and burn individual heretics. He wanted war. And for that, he needed, again, the secular muscle. He couldn't get the local barons interested. And so papal pressure finally did succeed in providing the military backing that this fanatical inquisitor needed. And he ravaged the valleys of Flessinière, L'Argentière, and Valpute. In the winter of 1385 to 1386, he led soldiers over the pass of Montgenèvre and burned the towns in the valley. Some villagers, once again, of Pragelato escaped into a snow-covered neighboring valley, exposed to the winds at over 10,000 feet, where many of them froze to death on Christmas Eve. The survivors returned to find their homes destroyed. And so these atrocities by Borelli, the inquisitor, went on for decades. In a single day in 1393, he burned 150 people at Grenoble. And there were others. In Italy, we have Inquisitor Antonio da Savigliano leading a severe persecution in Pinerolo and Torino, 1387 to 88. So the only thing that interrupted these atrocities was power struggles within the church hierarchy itself. And this was a time where the papacy underwent the Great Schism. There were two popes, one in Avignon, the other in Rome. Ambitious men, each claiming to be the sole legitimate pope. And it was the pope at Avignon who was the keenest to stamp out heretics in the mountains surrounding. So because their tormentors were distracted, the Alpine people raised the next generation on stories of the injustices that the Inquisition had inflicted on their families. And the children of those children would suffer renewed military onslaughts instigated by popes and inquisitors. More souls were destined for the stake, but these future generations would be burned as witches rather than as heretics. And another group that was being hunted by the Inquisition were the spiritual Franciscans. So this was a branch of the Franciscan movement who were radical Catholics, and they embraced the cause of the poor. They opposed the clergy's accumulation of great wealth and the rampant buying and selling of church offices, just the greed altogether. So we see the Pope issuing a bull to silence them in 1323. And he declared that their affirmation that Jesus and the apostles lived in poverty was heretical. You couldn't believe that. You could not mention the poverty of that. Of the founder, supposed founder of the religion. And the Pope that did this was Pope John the 22nd, whose popular tag was the banker of the Holy See. You know, he was involved in a lot of really dirty dealings, and he was also somebody who was really promoting persecution of witches, magicians. He himself employed magicians, but he was also attacking, you know, astrologers and people like that. But the Italian nickname for the spiritual Franciscans was more affectionate. They called them Fraticelli, the little brothers. Anyway, to the end of the 1300s, you see the spiritual Franciscans being hunted and burned at the stake, especially in France and Italy. This is where the movement was strongest. And they too, like other heretics and witches in this period, were accused of child-killing rites. Nobody believed this, of course, but it was effective nevertheless over time to use these blood libels. And one source here, I don't have it right in front of me, says, in places they were held in such esteem by the populace that the Inquisition and the civil courts found them powerless to bring them to trial. So anyhow, this was also in Spain in 1440. You still have a Franciscan spearheading a popular movement among the Basques in Durango. And this, a lot of women were involved in this movement. And this caused the clergy to turn around and accuse them of fornication. And there's evidence of severe repression also against these Spanish Franciscan movements. And so we see mass burnings going on in Durango, Valladolid, Santo Domingo de la Calzada, and many and many others were imprisoned in church dungeons. So the movement of these Franciscans, Alfonso, protested to King Juan II that the powerful were persecuting them for preaching the gospel. And he spoke of the, quote, crudity of the rigid and unjust laws established by them against those who in questions of faith have other opinions than the ancient doctors of the church. And he also expressed the people's desire to rebuild the church in a different way than what it has been until now. But other than this one speech, only priestly polemics against the Durango heretics have survived. They, the victors, write the histories. But it's interesting because we do see in the writings of the clergy from, for example, Fray Alonso de Cartagena, he considered the Durango heretics to be returned to the ancient Basque paganism. And here's another source. Diego de Valera wrote that they believed there was nothing other than birth and death. Another guy, Fernando de Munqueta, said that they believed that there should be no pope and, quote, all laws, institutions, and rituals will cease and everything will be in common. So this is a kind of commoner socialism, a popular movement of equality that they were working toward. And we know from other sources coming right up to the present day that communal values were a really long-standing sentiment in the Basque culture. And they were upheld by no less a personage than the Basque great goddess Mari herself. So I'm going to skip over a section here where I talk about the Luciferans. This is a group that is being named of supposed heretics. We don't really know much about them, who are being named as devil worshippers. But I don't want to go this too long. We'll do them in another section. Anyway, I want to come back to the Inquisitorial Wars. People fought the hounds of orthodoxy courageously and against great odds in Languedoc, 1232 to 1314, the Western Alps, 1288 to 1386, that's 100 years, Northern Italy, 1228 to 70. The Czech resistance to the Inquisition also flared briefly in the mid-1300s, then smoldered for another century, and blazed up finally in the Hussite Rebellion against the institutional church. Way over in the Balkans, Bosnians refused to yield throughout the entire long papal war against the Patarines. This is in from 1200 to 1450. And this is one reason why Bosnia finally was, so many Bosnians converted to Islam, because they had had an oppositional relation with the imperial church for all that time, for centuries. And the Bogomils, they were Manichaeans, eventually switched to Islam as something more compatible with their belief than the Catholic Church. So all of these persecutions and the resistance that they inspired has been a really well-kept historical secret. Only medievalists knew about them, and many of those didn't discuss them much either. So these are historical secrets. But before the influx of all these heretical refugees with the Inquisition at their heels, the church had a very weak hold, as I mentioned, on the Alpine villagers. And this is why the Vaudois chose to settle there. But why is it then that the Inquisition was able to prevail? And brute force is our answer, and the outcome of the peasant revolts, which were all defeated eventually. And it's because the civilian populations were just not equipped to resist the all-out attacks by a mounted military class trained in war from birth. In the Western Alps, the fatal blow was the invasion of 1486 to 90. This is also a period where witch hunts are very much up by the Inquisition. And the Pope, the Inquisition, and the governor of Dauphiné collaborated in this invasion. So the Alpine resistance lasted longer than many of the peasant risings that the French called the Jacquerie. But after a century of burnings and war crimes, atrocities, outward submission seemed unavoidable. They weren't making any headway. The more and more waves of knights and soldiers came up to their villages. And so the price of that submission was silence in the face of injustice for the sake purely of survival. And so now the ideology that powered the repression of the inquisitors went publicly unchallenged. And so as the inquisitorial ideology of diabolism, which had developed in the torture chambers and in the minds also of theologians, as diabolism became the crux of inquisitorial ideology, it created terrible repercussions in those mountain communities, because nobody could openly speak out and say this is complete bullshit. You know, these charges of women having sex with devils and, you know, all of the blood libels that were being spread about the witches. And so it made them vulnerable to those very memes, this very propaganda that the inquisitors were promoting. And so the torture trials of the Inquisition in these regions quickly turned to witch hunts. And we see Joseph Hansen, the German scholar of the 19th century, and others who looked at this burning craze, noticing that the Alpine border regions, which had been scoured for Vaudois heretics during the 1300s, produced mass witch persecutions in the 1400s. And these were primarily, in that time span, inquisitorial witch trials. And the name Vaudois came to mean witch instead of Christian heretic. We'll see other parallels to that in these persecutions. In the Jura Mountains of eastern France, for example, you have the word heretic starting to be used to describe practitioners of the magical arts. So a Swiss man tried for folk healing was known as le bon hérège, the good heretic. And we see inquisitorial trials around Torino and Pinerolo, 1387, charging Valdenses with holding diabolist assemblies. So the witchcraft charge is, it's like this heretical persecution is morphing into witch hunts in this region. And by the year 1400, Vauderie or Valdésie or Vaudoisie, all these various dialectical versions of the word for Valdenses, now meant sorcery. And this became the battle cry of the hunt masters. The name Cathar had also drifted in this direction. So in Savoy, the Inquisition was calling witches Gazzarii. This is a Latinized version of Cathars in the year 1425. The old association of Cathars with homosexuality had endured and began to blend with the diabolist themes that the inquisitors were spreading in the late 1300s and early 1400s. So the devil worship and sex with devil theme, the pornographies of the torture chamber are shifting this over. All these words for heretics in that context are becoming names for witches. And there's another term, I don't know if I mentioned it in this chapter, but the word Quetzal also means heretic in German. And Quetzal came to mean sodomite even more than it meant heretic, because of the slurs that were being invented about who these people were. So the sorcery charge proved to be an effective wedge. It split up communal solidarity and it shattered old cultural patterns. The accusation of witchcraft took root in the fear of Christian believers. And it was like a dagger in the heart of these independent mountain communities. It tore them apart. And so as the Alpine Crusades forced them into the mold of the dominant church, demonology begins to reach the people through sermons, the confessional, auto da fe, where people are being burned at the stake in public, and finally spread by the people themselves through rumors and accusations. And so the spirits of folk tradition were simply renamed. Animism became demonism. People still believe that all beings possessed vital force that kept them alive and healthy. It could be blocked, stolen, or removed. A seeress could divine what had thrown it into disorder. A healer could restore a person to well-being. But the priestly hierarchy persisted over centuries in redefining witches' healing powers and prophecy as working with demons, with devils. The same acts were defined as miracles when performed by priests and monks. But by the church's fiat, there was nothing left to the witch but acts of evil. And so the sorcery charge gains potency as the demonologists, theologians, transformed it into diabolism in the 1300s, devil worship, the charge of devil worship. Dread of a virulent new brand of sorcery was propelled into popular consciousness by the Inquisition's secret denunciations, arrests, torture trials, and executions. And in these executions, they would read out the charges. Sometimes they would tell the person, well, you won't be burned alive. We'll strangle you instead if you just assent to the charges being made against you. And so some people went for that. But then the people watching, all the people that came to observe this incineration of a human being, would tell each other later, well, she said it was true. She said that she did those things. And so that was very damaging. No one dared to openly oppose this diabolist ideology, which would have been ridiculous if it hadn't been so deadly. And so the accusations they spread began taking hold in a climate of disasters, political and economic collapse, the plague, as I mentioned before, and unprecedented suffering among the common people. So demonological doctrines gradually took root in the hearts of people who heard the sermons, saw the executions, and they were no longer sure what witches were or did or believed, and people were induced to fear them. They were told that witches were attempting to hide terrible secret atrocities when all they were really trying to do was to escape them, escape the inquisitors. Witchcraft had to become secret, and this was its downfall. So, you know, when I say witchcraft, we could expand that. Any kind of pagan customs, which up until that time were still being practiced, any old ancestral practices, healing practices, ceremonies, invocations, the nature sacraments especially, had to be transformed. They had to be given a Christian cover. You know, the old names had to be abandoned because there was too much suspicion being attached to it. So I'm going to be talking in future webcasts about these inquisitorial wars actually are later chronologically than some of the crusades against the pagans. And I'm going to be talking about those in another series of a couple webcasts talking about crusades against pagans in Central Europe and Northeastern Europe over a period of about more than 300 years. By the Teutonic Knights, the Brotherhoods of the Sword, these military monastic orders that were used as shock troops against the still thriving ethnic religions in the Baltic countries, the Lithuanians, the Latvians, the old Prussians, and others. So you're invited always to visit the website, sourcememory.net/historysybil. No, it's / Max Dashu, I think it is. If you enjoy this material, come along to my Patreon site, www.patreon.com/max-shu and throw a donation this way. Helps fund my ability to share this material. I have all this stuff written. It's sitting in file drawers, and I'm just in the process of sharing it out in this oral form, because it's going to be years before this volume on the Sorcery Charge ever sees print. But I think it's really important for us to understand how persecutory culture works and how the roots of that in European witch hunts and heretic hunts are then in turn exported in the European conquest of the rest of the world and are again used against indigenous people. So this is all of a piece. Thank you for listening. More later. Be blessed.